You're listening to The Political Fix, the show that investigates a political solution combining the best of the left and the right. Hosted by political visionary and entrepreneur Rick Raddatz, political expert and radio broadcaster Jay Amernick, and me, journalist in all media Heather Vale Goss, The Political Fix reveals the answers we're all looking for. Get on board and get your fix. Streaming live Wednesdays at 9 a.m. Pacific, noon Eastern, at politicalfixradio.com. And welcome to The Political Fix for Wednesday, May 14th. We've got another great show for you today. I'm Heather Vale Goss, and joining me is my co-host, Jay Amernick, who's a radio talk show host and strategic planner who helps his clients create and implement plans, goals, tactics, and benchmarks, also a former TV comedy writer. And Rick Raddatz, a serial entrepreneur with a degree in philosophy, which led to his development called The Solution, and Pentonomics, which is the philosophy behind the solution. I'm Heather Vale Goss, known as The Unwrapper. I'm a freelance interviewer and writer, and welcome to The Political Fix. Hey, guys, how are you going?
Good. How are you?
All right. I have some kind of cold or flu, but I have taken medication, and I think I can make it.
So, wow. Yeah. So this could be like a... Wow. Okay.
Yeah, well,
we could get loopy Heather today.
Yeah, a little loopy, okay. And my voice isn't totally there, but it's not gone. Like sometimes I get laryngitis and it just goes away. So
you sound like you're ready to cry.
I do. Okay.
like any moment you could just cry. I just had that feeling.
It's okay. The shakiness in the voice that the medication is causing, it's fine. It's actually fine. And to be honest, I don't think anybody would have noticed had you not brought it up.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I got that raspy. We can do like a little rock radio DJ type stuff today because I got almost that raspy voice. But you know, I'm never gonna have that.
I am so rock radio. That's me, babe, right there. Rock radio.
I'm ready for it. Rock stations. They're cool. They rock.
They rock. I'm not sure that I can rock.
Oh, okay.
It's in the Saturday Night Live, you know, white guy raps kind of stuff, right? That's me.
White guy rap.
That's not pretty.
Is that what you said?
I don't even remember it. See, I'm
like Eminem.
Describing it. Huh?
Like Eminem. The Beastie Boys.
Vanilla Ice.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm the vanilla, not the ice. Okay,
well,
so
I think we're all a little vanilla, but anyway.
Speak for yourself.
Oh, you're not?
No.
Okay.
No.
All right. I look vanilla more than I am, but yeah. So do you guys want to hear the top story?
Sure, why not?
Sure.
All right.
That's what we're here for.
Okay. All right, so a violent protest erupted today in the Turkish city of Soma, where at least 238 coal miners have died after a mine explosion. Many in the crowd expressed anger at Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan and his government. So they were throwing rocks, and some people were shouting that he was a murderer and a thief. The protesters faced off against riot police who had gas masks and water cannons in front of the ruling NKP party headquarters. Earlier today, some cried loudly while others just stared in disbelief outside a coal mine in western Turkey as rescue workers removed a steady stream of bodies after the underground explosion and fire. The fate of an estimated 120 miners remained unclear in one of Turkey's worst mining disasters. Erdogan postponed a foreign trip and visited the mine in Soma, about 155 miles south of Istanbul. The deaths were caused by carbon monoxide poisoning, according to officials. Erdogan said the tragedy would be investigated to its smallest detail and no negligence will be ignored. He discussed rescue operations with authorities, walked near the entrance of the mine, and also comforted two crying women. Earlier, he declared 3 days of national mourning, ordering flags to be lowered to half staff. 787 people were inside the coal mine at the time of yesterday's explosion, and 363 of them have been rescued. Scores were injured, and more than 400 rescuers have been hard at work. Tensions were high as relatives and miners stood outside the mine surrounded by heavy police presence. They shouted at officials, and some cried every time a body was brought up. Mining accidents are actually common in Turkey, which is plagued by poor safety conditions. Turkey's worst mining disaster was a 1992 gas explosion that killed 263 workers near the Black Sea port of Zonguldak. So that's our story.
Yeah. It, you know, Turkey's been plagued for a while with poor infrastructure. There was a there was an earthquake. I can't remember what year it was, 2000 and maybe 8. Maybe it was earlier. I can't remember, but basically, you know, the entire country fell apart, and they never retrofitted anything. These are problems with a emerging country like Turkey.
Yeah,
you know, you say emerging country. Well, it's been emerging for a while now. The whole third world has been emerging for a while now. Isn't it amazing?
They're like a second and a half world country. I mean, they're exactly.
I mean, they were on their way. They're going to join the EU and the whole bit. And
yeah.
You know, here we are in the U.S. and a lot of Europe is a lot like us. You know, we're really advanced in a lot of ways, very mature. You know, our problems, you know, are a whole different set of problems generally. You know. We've elevated our safety standards. We've gotten taken care of a lot of pollution issues that were like acid rain in the 80s and that kind of stuff. And it seems to me like all we've really done in the last couple decades here regarding workplace conditions and environmental regulations within the United States is we've raised the bar here in our country. But by doing so, we've essentially outsourced all of that risk and environmental problems to the rest of the world. You know, we haven't solved anything. We just made it nicer here. But
right.
We've actually created the problems over there.
So are you blaming the U.S. for the explosion in Turkey?
No, I'm saying let's not think we've solved it here. We haven't solved it here. We've just pushed it away. This is a real problem.
Well, the infrastructure problems in Turkey have a great deal to do with the corruption of the Erdogan government and previous governments there that just have not done anything to, like I said, to retrofit anything, to even look at these problems.
You're right. In that sense, outsourcing is the wrong word because it was always screwed up over there. And it screwed up someplace. But I guess what I'm saying is we're taking advantage of the rest of the world indirectly, even if we don't believe it, we are, because just by raising the bar here and making people step up here, that means that the industries that can't afford to pay that price have to go elsewhere. And so we're still leveraging the rest of the world that can't afford that price. And I guess all I'm saying is that we in the first world, we have not solved the problems we think we've solved.
Well, a lot of times we put forward what I call feel-good legislation, and yes, it is important for, you know, workplaces to not be death traps, but there's got to be a second piece to it that somehow stems what you suggest is that okay, so we've made these, you know, improvements here, but what does that do? That raises the price of everything, so we have to look to manufacture things elsewhere where maybe it's not so safe. And so we only do sort of the good feel good part of it. We don't do the dirty work part of it because that's no fun to and unpopular to try to pass.
What kind of legislation do you think that they've passed that was just for feel good and didn't actually accomplish safety?
No. It's not that it doesn't accomplish, it's that it accomplishes part of it. But
okay.
It makes people think like, hey, we did it, we're done.
Right.
So you know, Upton Sinclair writes the jungle, and then all of a sudden, you know, the government goes in and says, "Well, you can't. These are hard conditions. It is now illegal for you to do this." You know, and legislation was passed. However, they don't always look at the full problem. They look at sort of what they can sort of wrap themselves around immediately, a photo op, and then sort of let the whole problem fade away.
Okay.
So they go for it because people like bright and shiny things, so they'll hit the bright and shiny thing, right? And then not look at the, not get their hands dirty.
So you're saying the legislators are going through this process of throwing out one bright shiny thing after another and saying, "Hey, look, we did this. There's another shiny thing."
No, not as a totality. They often do that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Without regard to the entire chessboard.
They're looking at the trees instead of the forest.
Well, in some cases, yes. Look,
I'm going to argue that no one's looking at the forest. Except no one's looking at the forest. Economic theory of government. What's that?
Okay. No one's looking at the forest except for Rick. Okay, gotcha.
Except for me. And other people who get it. You guys get it, I think, mostly. Yeah. The point is this. We're not going to solve Turkey's problems by trying to directly solve Turkey's problems. That's impossible. We can't come into Afghanistan, a country which we largely control militarily, and fix their economy and their democracy. You know, how we're going to do it to a truly independent state like Turkey that's more established, has their traditions, their momentum, their religions and their cultures and their clashes and so on. This is not going to happen. So you got to solve the problem at its root. And at its root, we haven't figured out how to run our country right yet with regards to our collective resources. But as soon as we do, as soon as we figure this out, and we can solve things like social justice and freedom and the debate between the two camps here in our country, then other modern countries who are ready can copy us and get better, and the poor democracies can copy us and get better too, and then we can start to go towards the almost democracies, the ones on the edge, and that's how we're going to spread. We're going to solve this problem by solving our own problems. But let's just realize that until we solve our problems really completely, we're not going to be exporting the solution. We're just going to be in this muddled confusion. Let me give you an example.
Okay.
Something like capitalism took 10,000 years to really mature. Okay, and it wasn't until a couple hundred years ago that it really got mature enough for people like Adam Smith to document it and for other people to understand it. And that's when it really started to spread in a very modern sense of the word. So in democracy, you know, there are examples of democracy a couple thousand years ago, and probably before that we just didn't know about it. But it took until just a couple hundred years ago when James Madison and our founding fathers really got it right with the republican structure of government, the republic, the multi-tier republic that you know, kind of counteracts itself. That's when other countries started adopting our constitution or versions of it, and it was the spread and stick. So what I'm saying is we need to do the same type of advancement here in terms of how we manage our collective resources. When we achieve that kind of good result, the pursuit of social justice through collective action is as mature as the pursuit of economic justice through capitalism or the pursuit of political justice through democracy, that's when we'll start to be able to fix the solution and really change the world.
Okay. So you're talking about creating the model for other countries to follow. Do you think that there's any countries out there that have it right that we could follow?
Well, there's certainly pockets. I mean, like Chile and other countries that have tried to adopt some of Milton Friedman's work have shown great promise. Australia, with the way that they do Social Security, I believe. Canada, the way they reformed a lot of their entitlements.
Canada.
Canada. But the other entitlements where they let the provinces have more control over how to prioritize the various entitlement type funding, the social spending. You know, these are all things that appear to be working better than what we have, and we can borrow from that. And you know, it's that's the way the world has always worked. You know, some country had more success than the other, and the ideas were borrowed eventually. It just takes time, you know, a generation or two.
Yeah.
Before things spread.
All right. Well, let's take a break, and when we come back, we'll have some more discussion. We'll be right back with you on Political Fix Radio. Welcome back to The Political Fix. I'm Heather Vale Goss, here with Jay Amernick and Rick Raddatz. And before the break, we were discussing our top story, which surrounded a mine explosion in Turkey. And now we're going to move on and discuss some other political issues. We've got a new segment this week, guys.
We do?
Yeah, we do. We do. We have a new segment. It's called Inside Perspective with Jay Amernick.
Oh, and... holy. I'm kidding.
I'm really excited because Jay has... Jay, just tell us quickly, what is your experience in the political world?
I was the Nevada State Director for AIPAC, which is the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, which is the most effective foreign policy lobby in the United States. I also worked for the Israel Project, which is a strategic communications organization, which gauges public opinion and all that type of stuff. One of the key things I worked on here in Nevada was some legislation regarding nuclear proliferation. Okay. I know, enjoyable, fun stuff. But that's what we did. And then other issues I worked on were foreign aid and the peace process and things like that.
Okay. That sounds like quite the varied experience.
Yes. I wanted to quickly just start at the beginning and just do a quick, lobbyists tend to get a very bad rap. And I think a lot of it's misunderstood. When then Senator Obama was running, he said no lobbyists. What he was talking about were the sort of hired guns that live on K Street in Washington D.C. Who, no matter what your deal is, you come and give them some money, and they will go talk to any given member of Congress. The real lobbyists, the bulk of them, are in the advocacy world. And I would suggest that all of us listening to this show, and obviously the three of us, are represented by lobbyists on Capitol Hill every day. And it's a good thing. Whether you're a veteran, you are represented by Veterans Affairs lobbyists on Capitol Hill who are doing everything they can to try to enhance your situation. Heather, for you, there are lobbyists on Capitol Hill who are, dealing with, Canadians living in the United States. Now keep in mind, now they are U.S. Organizations, you can't be a registered lobbyist and be a foreign agent. It doesn't work that way. You have to be a U.S. citizen in order to lobby the U.S., Congress.
Okay.
So it really is a positive thing, and it's a great way to maximize your voice. And for even those who I would suggest don't have a voice, that we don't normally think of as having a voice, the homeless have lobbyists on Capitol Hill every day who are, they're funded by someone else. Obviously the homeless don't have, the funds in order to hire them. But these are people who care deeply about this issue, and they've made it their livelihood to go to Capitol Hill and try to solve these problems, and it's actually the best form of advocacy. I've been to Capitol Hill many times to lobby my members of Congress, and that one-on-one meeting, whether it's 5 minutes, whether it's 10 minutes, whatever it is, to say thank you and then to sort of go over the legislation with them, is much more powerful than the people you see holding the signs. And doing what I call, and it's two words I hate, and it's raising awareness, because it really doesn't do anything at the end of the day. It goes back to what I said before about the it feels good. We did it. We shouted at the top of our lungs, and we went home. And at the end of the day, the problem still exists. No member of Congress heard it, and is not influenced by it at all, and doesn't understand the issue. All he saw were a bunch of people holding signs and shrieking.
Okay, but isn't raising awareness kind of the first step in solving any problem? I mean, whether it's quitting smoking, whether it's treating our spouse better, it's...
But again, the most effective way to do that is through retail engagement. is by you, the anti-smoker, going up to the smoker and saying, you know what, you have 10 minutes. Let me just tell you some stuff. And educating them, and then turning that education into engagement. That's really the best way. Protesting, you know, don't smoke, doesn't have the desired effect.
Okay.
If in fact the desired effect is to get people to stop smoking, for instance.
Right. But you're talking about a one-to-one approach, and I mean, logical mind says one-to-many is going to be more effective than one-to-one. On a grander scale.
Well, it's one to who? If it's one to one and the person you're talking to is the, you know, U.S. Senate member, you know, that's pretty powerful.
Right. Okay. Yeah, that makes
sense. Right. But then the idea of being able to go to that member of Congress and saying, look, I'm here with these 20 citizens who've come to Washington, D.C. on their own dime to stop by your office and say hello is a big deal. Because there's an equation they have worked out in their head, and it's literally like for every phone call they get, they assume that means something like 10 people feel that way. For every letter they get, 100 people. But again, for someone who gets on a plane, flies to Washington, D.C., and goes to their office for a meeting, it's like 1 to 10,000 people. I mean, it's exponential.
Okay. So is being a lobbyist an actual career path, or is this just something that's born out of passion?
Is it a career path? Yes, it can be.
Because you said they make it their livelihood, but to me that means they're actually making a living at it.
Absolutely. There are lobbyists that work for different organizations they have to get paid. You know, they have mortgages and kids to put through school and all that, like all the rest of us. You know, and there's nothing wrong with that. Now, some of them, you know, will eventually, like, I was never what you would call a registered lobbyist. I did lobby, but I was not, but my main goals were, you know, sort of community organization here, forming, you know, political alliances, and then maintaining the relationships with the members of Congress from the Nevada congressional delegation. But yes, there are people, you know, live in Washington, D.C., and that is their full-time job is lobbying. And they are literally the experts on the issues that they're lobbying on. And they, you know, will bring the legislation to the members of Congress and say, it does these three things. Can we count on your support for it?
Okay.
And then if the answer is no, then it's like, well, let's talk about that. What are your issues with it?
Yeah, that actually sounds kind of fun. Being able to make a difference like that and follow your passion.
Yeah, it is. And again, there's, like I said, literally everybody in the United States is represented by at least one. It should be more lobbyists on Capitol Hill. You know, Washington's a funny place. There's associations for everything. You know, the association of outside of like unions and all those things, there's also like the Association of Steelworkers, Association of this, Association of that. And there's actually, and I love this, in Washington, D.C., there's an association of associations. and it's just, you know, it's all sort of like minds getting together and figuring out, okay, what's best going to, you know, help us out here.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay, so Jay, what's your point? That the career paid lobbyist guns for hire are bad?
Both do it for a career. But what I'm suggesting is that when they got this bad name, it was when then Senator Obama said, you know, there'll be no lobbyists in my White House type thing. And basically, you know, everyone sort of applauded, and I'm thinking, you know, you people are represented by lobbyists every day on Capitol Hill. Whatever your profession is.
I'm sorry. So your point is that all lobbyists, even the ones
he was referring to were those hired guns. They may not; those are not in the advocacy world. They are literally a gun for hire, and will, you know, it doesn't matter, you know, who you are. And sometimes they get in a little bit of trouble. If you remember, Jack Abramoff got into some hot water
Yeah, he, for not, well, he was doing not behaving illegal ethically. Things, right? Okay, but wait, but Jay, I'm confused what your point here of the segment is. Are you saying that all lobbyists are good and we should be thankful that they exist, or that some are good and some bad?
Well, some are. Some are unethical, but the majority of them are working for an advocacy organization and are representing you, the people, on Capitol Hill every day.
Mm-hmm.
I'm
going to agree with you, and I think taking it a step further, even the hired gun ones, the ones that cross the line, there's certain rules in place. The people who cross those lines, bad. Well, you got to find them and stop them from doing that. But I'm going to say that even the hired gun lobbyists are part of this adversarial system. We're supposed to be fighting each other in this way through lobbying, so that the right stuff gets done. So I'm going to agree with you that the lobbyists are not the problem. They're doing what they're incentivized to do. We may not like one special interest group, but we like our own special interest group. As I think that's the point you're making in the beginning there. Is that we're all represented by, I'm a small business owner, and there's a small business lobby. It's a very powerful lobby, and they act in a lot of different things. So to all the people out there that think lobbyists equals bad or corrupt or whatever, there's corruption out there, yes, but it's not, that's not a lobbying problem. It's an overall problem.
It's not widespread.
It's a transparency problem. The problem is that the government politicians can do these deals, and there's no because there's no prioritized budget, things flip in there. If the budget was prioritized, the bridge to nowhere couldn't be in there. The deal for a certain company couldn't be in there because something else would have to fall off the cliff. And to argue where that fits in the priority list be very hard. So it's the lack of priority transparency that's the problem, not the existence of lobbyists. You agree?
Yes, absolutely.
All right.
You encapsulated my point brilliantly.
All right.
Cool. All right. So, guys, you want to take another break, and then we'll be back, and we're going to find out more about the movement from Rick. So we'll be right back with you on Political Fix. Welcome back to The Political Fix. I'm Heather Vail-Goss, here with my co-hosts Jay Amernick and Rick Raddatz. Before the break, we were talking about lobbyists on Capitol Hill, and Jay made the point that lobbyists are crucial to our existence, and they should not be put down the way some politicians like to put them down. Guys, do you have anything to add to that before
I was going to say, even the politicians putting them down goes back to that feel-good type legislation, because it gets a big round of applause. From people who don't understand the system.
It seems like lobbyists, if they're smart, apparently they're not. If lobbyists were smart, they'd have their own lobby, and they would fix their brand image.
Lobbyists for lobbyists. Okay.
If they're in the business of helping groups advocate for themselves, why can't they advocate for themselves and have a good brand image?
Because they're failing. That would be, I think they do that on an individual basis per organization. For instance, I can tell you there's nobody who's involved.
There should be an Association of American Lobbyists, and they should lobby for themselves.
They may be, I don't know. I can tell you anybody who was involved with AIPAC, didn't buy that line about lobbyists being bad. People who are involved in these organizations. It's not a widespread hatred. Nobody's pulling out the torches and forming a mob. Oddly enough, they are in the business of presenting issues, and they do have a somewhat tarnished image. So I just did my bit to try to untarnish it a little bit.
All right.
In my own little way.
Okay, so Heather, where are we in the show here?
Well, if anyone wants to call in and join the discussion, they can call us at 1-888-627-6008, either with questions or comments. That's 1-888-627-6008. And Rick, while we're waiting for that, if anyone wants to join us, why don't you tell us more about the whole Pentanomics and, you know, tell us about why we're even here. What are we talking about?
Oh, okay, yeah. So Pentanomics is a brand new political philosophy, and it points the way towards the solution to our big political divide and on even worldwide problems. And here's the way to think about it. When most people think about the modern world, they count to three, because they count capitalism as a big thing, they count democracy as a big thing, and diplomacy slash defense, you know, as a big thing, okay? So to make it simple, we'll say capitalism, diplomacy, and democracy. Those are the
usually, but don't they, when they say capitalism, don't they automatically say socialism as well?
Well, some people think socialism is the other choice. Like, if you don't like capitalism, maybe we can go socialism and we can dial it up and down, have a mixed economy and so on. And that actually is part of what I'm trying to say here, is that these three pillars are just three pillars. There's actually two more pillars. And the fact that we're all missing this is why we're all confused and we're talking about socialism and all this other kind of stuff. Think about it this way. Capitalism does a pretty good job, or at least we try to, of incentivizing individuals the right way, individual people, individual companies. We want to incentivize them to help each other, help the people, as opposed to just steal from everyone else. And democracy is an attempt to properly incentivize politicians, because we want politicians to serve the people, to pander to the people, not force us to pander to them. And diplomacy and national defense is all about trying to properly incentivize foreign nations to get them to do things in our interest instead of build up an army and invade us. And what I'm saying is we have to do all that, but we also have to do two more things. We have to count to five, not three. And these two more things are, first, we have to properly incentivize us as a collective, you know, we the voters, we the people. We have to properly incentivize us to essentially vote correctly. Or to get our politicians to vote correctly on our behalf. And so we, the collective, have to properly incentivize ourselves. And right now we aren't properly incentivized. People are incentivized to call each other enemies. They're incentivized to take more money from the people than we have. No matter how much money the government raises, politicians are incentivized to spend more on us than they take from us. You know, these are perverse incentives. Politicians are incentivized to respond to the bad lobbyists, as opposed to, we hope, the better lobbyists. And so the incentives are wrong. And then when it comes to we as a species, we are incentivized right now to think about our current selves and maybe a generation or two. We are not incentivized to think about what we need to worry about over 10,000 years. But if we want to survive 10,000 years, we're now at the point where we have to think about limiting our collective activity at a global scale. And we aren't mature enough to think about that yet. So, but here's the big insight, is that the structures that help us properly incentivize individuals, politicians, and foreign nations, those same structures can also help us properly incentivize the collective and we as a species. And you can learn more about that at the movement's website at incentivereform.org. There's a TED Talk there that goes into it, about a 15-minute TED Talk. So that's the quick summary of Pentanomics, is that everyone else counts to three, and we count to five.
Okay. I think human nature is not to think 10,000 years in the future. Whether or not they're incentivized,
right.
It's just not how most people think. They don't think about keeping the generations going for 10,000 years. They might think a couple hundred years in the future. They might think, okay, my kids' grandkids, but 10,000 years,
yeah.
I mean, that's a stretch. Some people don't even think the world's that old, so.
that's true.
Just saying.
It's exactly those kinds of discussions that we need to have, because clearly if one wise person was in charge of the whole human race, okay, we had one emperor that was actually wise and benevolent. That one wise person, if we are going to call him wise or her wise, that wise person would certainly be thinking about a longer term. That would be the definition of wise. So I agree with you that a single individual given everything that's going on in the world and their own desire to just live, let alone thrive, for 10,000 years, the pressures are such that we can't afford to do that right now. We can't afford to worry about 10,000 years from now. We need to worry about today. Russia is invading Crimea, and the Middle East is going weird, and China is doing weird things too. And so these things are happening, and so we can't afford to worry about 10,000 years from now. And I agree with that. The effort to think about environmental sustainability over 10,000 years, that it has to come last. Okay, that's the last thing humanity is going to solve. As we talked about last week, we need to solve fiscal sustainability before we can tackle the larger problem of environmental sustainability. And so we have to realize that the incentives that properly incentivize individuals, although the structure might be the same, the actual implementation is different. If you want to stop a person from stealing, you have to have a country strong enough to have property rights. They have property rights to be meaningful. And to encourage people to pay the right price, you need to have a free market. So the free market can figure out most of the time what the right price is. To do the same two things with our collective spending, with government spending, you need to have a different type of limit and a different type of transparency. You need a limit that says, look, here's our budget. We're going to have a spending cap and a regulation cap and a tax cap or something like that. We're going to limit what we do to ourselves in terms of gathering resources. We're going to limit that so that we can't take too much. And then that's only step one, though. That's the fiscal conservative step. The social progressive step is step two, where we say, look, within these limits, we're going to prioritize so that the stupid stuff falls off the cliff and better stuff comes in to replace it. And that's where we see constant improvement over time. So we're creating an economy out of our collective resources by making ideas compete in a priority marketplace. And we're creating the peer of capitalism. But this peer of capitalism is going to pursue social justice. And again, all this is explained on the video, the TED Talk at incentivereform.org. And it's also, by the way,
at politicalfixradio.com.
Politicalfixradio has it too. Okay, cool. There you go, yeah. Politicalfixradio.com.
Getting back to the 10,000 year thing, it seems that actually this concept actually creates that long-term view without making us think, oh my God, 10,000 years.
Here's how it's going to happen. And we already see a little bit of this today. As soon as enough countries have healed themselves, we have some mature countries, they're going to start requiring each other to step up environmentally if they want to be part of the global marketplace. And we already see a little bit of this. But as soon as true maturity breaks out across the world in terms of running individual nations, that's when these mature individual nations will start forcing each other to step up environmentally. And that's going to be at a national level or an international level that humanity starts to live within our means. Individuals themselves, you can't expect an individual to sacrifice for someone 10,000 years in the future. But the structure of competition at the international level is going to force this in time.
Right. Okay. So for people that are listening to you talk, Rick, and trying to figure out where exactly you fit on the political spectrum from left to right, what's the answer?
Uh-huh. Well, that's kind of my Rick's rant today. Is it time for the Rick's rant?
No, let's save that till after the break because it's almost break time.
I'll give you a short answer right now.
Okay.
I'm a political moderate. Okay.
And
the reason that might seem strange, because I'm so emotional about these things, is that most moderates don't take their own philosophy seriously. And that's going to be the Rick's rant, is that I am a strong moderate. I believe in the combination of being fiscally conservative and socially progressive at the same time. And if you think about what that really means, you come to this stronger conclusion. It's still a moderate position. It's just a stronger belief.
Okay, awesome. So we will get to that Rick's rant right after the break, and we're going to take another break now. We'll be right back with you on Political Fix. Welcome back to the Political Fix. I'm Heather Vale Goss here with my co-hosts Jay Amernick and Rick Raddatz. And as we were talking about before the break, Rick is getting ready to rant about being a moderate, which is kind of an odd concept, because we think of moderates as being not that passionate, not that dedicated to one thing or another, kind of just sitting on the fence, sitting in the middle. But apparently, that's not the case, as Rick's going to tell us. You ready to rant, Rick?
I am, but I think I need like a little theme song for Rick's rant. So I'm going to rant about not having a theme song, maybe.
Oh, no, we need a theme song. Okay, well, we'll have to...
How about Take It by a Twisted Sister?
Okay.
Yeah, so, that's good.
So I'm going to rant about being a moderate. So this rant goes out to all the moderates on the left, all the moderates on the right, and all the moderates in between. And my rant is this. It's time for us to unite. It's time for us to organize. It's time for us to lead our country so we can heal our country, because the country's in trouble. We're suffering economically, socially, politically, internationally, globally, and these problems are not going to be solved by the left or the right. It has to be the left and the right. We all have a piece of the puzzle, and moderates understand that. That's the definition of a moderate, is that, to take one example, we are fiscally conservative and socially progressive at the same time. That's what all of us moderates say. Okay, now, the purists on both sides, they hear that. They hear us say that we're fiscally conservative and socially progressive at the same time, and they don't know what that means. They think it's a joke. Okay, they think we're saying that, but we don't mean it. And maybe they're right. Maybe they're right, because we say it, but do we really mean it? And I'm going to challenge all moderates today to think about what their philosophy really means. What does it mean to be fiscally conservative and socially progressive at the same time? If you're truly fiscally conservative, then that means that you're in favor of some kind of spending cap or balanced budget amendment that, at a minimum, guarantees fiscal sustainability, even in the face of unknown dangers and in the future. Like, we have to be so living within our means as a nation that we can afford hurricanes and wars and goofy stuff happening. Okay? These things shouldn't tip us over financially. And if we're truly socially progressive, then within that cap, we're going to make government somehow prioritize its spending publicly, transparently, so that the transparency of a prioritized budget helps ensure that the people who need help most win that priority battle, and the ideas that help them the most win that priority battle. And so that every year, as we prioritize and reprioritize, we're constantly pushing off the foolish and greedy spending, forcing government spending over time to become ever more wise and benevolent. And you need a wise and benevolent government to be socially progressive. So you care about the people who need help most, and you care about the programs that help them the most, and so that we get better and better at achieving social justice. And notice that if you want to force greedy and foolish spending off a cliff, there's got to be a cliff. Okay? There has to be a spending cap in order to force the greed and foolishness out of government spending. So we, the moderates, we have the right philosophy. We have the right principles. We have the right proposal, cap and prioritize. We just need to organize. And you know what? We don't need 100 million moderates. We don't need a new political party, God forbid. Okay? That's too much work anyway. We're moderates. All we need is 1 million moderates to come together and unite and listen to this radio show every week so that we can have an organization, and leaders will emerge, and funding will emerge, and we can have a voice in politics. We have no voice right now. But we, the moderates, we are the silent majority. 80% of people, at least in this country, adults, would be willing to accept some sort of compromise. That means that we have 80% of the voting population are moderate in some degree. We are the majority, but we are a sleeping giant, and we have to organize. And that's Rick's rant for today.
Okay, awesome. You know, the way that I like to describe it is, I think a lot of people understand this too, is it's really important to give a hand up rather than a hand out. And there's that old saying that if you give a man a fish, he eats for a day. If you teach him to fish, he can eat for a lifetime. And that's what you're talking about, capping and prioritizing. It's like, okay, let's help the people to a degree when they need it the most, and then make them self-sufficient so they can go off on their own. And that's the cap. And that's how I see it.
Yeah, depending on how you work the cap, it could also be a guarantee. meaning if you say social spending will always grow at a certain rate relative to population plus inflation, that's a cap. It can't grow any faster, but it's also a guarantee. It won't grow any slower, meaning you'll always have money to fund the programs you're talking about.
Okay.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting.
I'm sorry, Jay, I interrupted you. Go ahead.
That's okay. No, what's interesting, and another thing sort of people don't know about how things work on Capitol Hill, all they see is the news and the wedge issues. You know, the majority of legislation gets passed with an overwhelming bipartisan support. So there is that political will to work together. And not only that, most legislation actually passes with a Republican co-sponsor and a Democrat co-sponsor. And that goes back to the, you know, what Benjamin Franklin said about the, you know, everybody working together and you know, forming like a dovetail joint. You know, you shave a little bit off here, you shave a little bit off here, and finally the thing fits together and you have a joint that'll last for, you know, 1,000 years.
So the 1,000-year joint, is that what you're proposing?
No, you're not.
I think it's kind of a Colorado thing.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, or Canada.
And if yeah. I invented that, I wouldn't be here talking to you guys.
So Hitler talked about like a 1,000-year Reich, right?
Yeah,
so
that was.
We're talking about a 1,000-year joint. I think we're going in the wrong direction here. This is not the right analogy.
Well, it's idea that you have a structure that's going to hold steady, and it holds steady because both sides had to give a little bit to make it fit.
Yeah, no, I'm teasing you. I get your point I think people, they hear the news and the whole debate and the political campaign, and in the campaign they gotta fight each other, of course, and so they attack what they can, which is this division. But study after study has shown that the people themselves are still largely moderate, and even the politicians are willing to work together if only they could. No one's figured it out. But that's what the cap and prioritize model has figured out. So that's why we have to join together and spread this message. And it starts here. It starts by listening to the show, learning about the philosophy, and then inviting others to listen to the show too, and we keep on growing that way.
One step at a time.
Yes. Well, and then again, that goes back to what I was saying too, that retail engagement. You start off with, you know, one person to get it going, and then
the one-to-one,
Yeah, because that's how people get engaged and inspired when
okay.
you can explore.
I am not going out on the Las Vegas Strip and handing out cards to people saying go listen to this radio show.
No, that's
just not doing it.
No, because that's actually
Heather.
Effective.
Why not?
Well,
how committed are you?
Really?
I think you should wear one of those like little placards, you know, front and back with the radio show, and then.
Now you gotta slap the cards. This is the way they do it in Vegas. It's like slap, slap, hand, slap, slap.
but most people like passing out cards on the Las Vegas Strip or not. They would be very disappointed when they get it. There's something political on it.
Yeah, you might find some really angry moderates then.
I was speaking at a marketing convention in Las Vegas, and I stepped out for a break, and someone handed me some you know flyer which was obscene.
Yeah.
And before I could do anything with it, the next person walked up and said, "Nice flyer, Rick." And I'm like, how does the guy know who I am? Well, I still have my name tag on from the conference. It was really embarrassing.
Well, so now you know not to accept, you know, strange pamphlets from people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, those pamphlet guys are aggressive. They have a job to do. Get rid of those pamphlets without throwing them away, you know. And,
yeah. And they do that for like $5 an hour.
Is that what it is?
Yeah.
Well, that's not minimum wage.
No.
Yeah, but they're not.
They're not official.
Citizens of the United States of America.
They're not even residents. They're not. Yeah, they're illegal.
Okay.
For the most part, not saying that they all are. I don't know.
We would presume.
Yeah. I know that some of them are. I have insider information that some of them are.
Yeah, not just, you know, not a lot of MBAs doing that.
Right. Yeah. Exactly.
Not yet.
Yeah, but it depends on how bad the economy gets.
All right, so guys, it looks like we're at the end of another show. Do you have anything to say before we wrap it up?
Who, me?
Anybody.
No, just thanks for listening and go to the politicalfixradio.com.
Yeah.
Yeah, and to anyone who's watching this one of these early shows here, I want to thank you for tuning in. And this is the beginning. This is how things start by being authentic, by being who you are, and wanting to change the world and getting involved. So get involved, and we will change the world.
Yeah, and so everything that you need is at politicalfixradio.com. politicalfixradio.com. We've got the archives of the behind-the-scenes videos. We've got the archives of the radio broadcasts. We've got live streams for both the video and the audio. And we also have Rick's TEDx talk, where he talks about the concepts behind the solution and Pentanomics. And a lot more stuff is going to be added there soon. So politicalfixradio.com is your place to go. And we'll be back with you next week on behalf of myself, Heather Vale Goss, Jay Emmernick, and Rick Raddatz. Hope to talk to you soon.
Thank you for listening to The Political Fix, the show that investigates a political solution combining the best of the left and the right. On behalf of Rick Raddatz, Jay Emmernick, and myself, Heather Vale Goss, we're glad you chose to get your fix with us. We need reform to fix this country, and incentive reform is what will make a difference. The five economies and resources laid out in Pentanomics and the strategies we call cap and prioritize are the focus of Rick's vision of the optimal political future. Every week we talk about the answers we've dug up among ourselves and with political experts who have the ability to make change happen. Get on board and get your fix. Streaming live Wednesdays at 9 a.m. Pacific, noon Eastern, at politicalfixradio.com.